we had no visual confirmation of the condition of the plane. So yeah, I would say we were hopeful for a happy outcome.
Rangers battling poor weather find multiple fatalities after a flight seeing tour crash near Denali. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the FCC commissioner is set to begin his tour of Unalaska communications systems.
He's a relatively new commissioner, and there's a lot of Alaska-based issues in front of the FCC at this point, so I think he's just looking to learn.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
And by Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Four people are confirmed dead, with a fifth unaccounted for and presumed dead after a crash in Denali National Park on Saturday. It is the first fatal crash in the Alaska Range involving a commercial operator since 2003. KTNA's Philip Manning reports.
On Monday morning, the National Park Service saw a potential window to reach the site of a de Havilland Beaver that crashed 14 miles southwest of the summit of Denali on Saturday. Bad weather had kept rescuers away Saturday night and all day Sunday. Catherine Belcher, Public Information Officer for Denali National Park and Preserve, says there was hope that the five people aboard the plane might still be alive.
We had no visual confirmation of the condition of the plane, so yeah, I would say we were hopeful for a happy outcome.
The happy outcome was not to be, however. The rescue helicopter was able to reach the crash site on a narrow ridge known as Thunder Mountain, and a ranger was lowered on a tether to inspect the plane. He was able to reach the downed beaver and confirm that at least four of its occupants were dead.
So he had a very small window of space, or a very small area where he could actually get close enough to the plane to kind of look inside. And unfortunately, he was able to see that four of the passengers were deceased. He couldn't actually get inside the aircraft and do any kind of real investigation. He was only on the ground for about 5 minutes.
With the weather closing in quickly, the ranger was not able to locate the plane's fifth occupant. But Catherine Belcher says conditions are such that the person is presumed dead as well.
The body may still be in the plane, but we just couldn't see until we can get a little more time on the ground. We won't know for certain, but we're pretty confident that the person did not get out of the aircraft.
On Monday afternoon, the National Park Service identified the pilot of the aircraft as Craig Lason of Saline, Michigan. The Saline Post newspaper says Lason is married with three children. The four passengers aboard have not been identified, but all were Polish citizens, according to the National Park Service. What was a search and rescue has now become a recovery effort. Catherine Belcher says park personnel are developing plans for when the weather clears.
They're working on some plans right now because they want to recover the bodies. The aircraft recovery will probably come later. We're looking at the next window of opportunity for clear weather, maybe as early as Wednesday, but maybe later in the week.
K2 Aviation, the company that owns the plane, released a statement Monday saying its staff are grieving the loss of life and that the company is cooperating with all agencies involved in the recovery and investigation. The company has suspended all flight seeing tours in the wake of Saturday's fatal crash. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A man has died in a pack rafting accident in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. Park Service officials say 22-year-old Aiden Don of Salzburg, Austria, died Thursday. His body was recovered Friday from the Nizina River. Don and a friend were dropped off by plane for a day-long trip on the river. Officials say they became separated a few miles downriver. The surviving rafter made an emergency call for help after seeing Don's capsized raft, but no sign of him. Aerial searchers located Don's body and also picked up the survivor. Because of the difficulty reaching the body, a helicopter was required the next day. The city of Kodiak has settled a lawsuit with the family of an autistic man who was pepper sprayed by a Kodiak police officer in 2015. The Pletnikoff family first filed suit in Kodiak Superior Court against the city in 2016. Body cam footage captured the encounter between now 30-year-old Nick Pletnikoff and three police officers. The officers arrived at the scene after a pair of tourists, a father and son, called 911 when they saw Pletnikoff nearby their car and believed he was attempting to break in. According to family attorney Josh Fitzgerald, Pletnikoff was returning home with his family's mail. The video shows officers forcing Pletnikoff to the ground and Sergeant Francis De La Fuente pepper spraying him in the face in response to what he saw as resistance. De La Fuente said he did not know Pletnikoff was autistic at the time. However, one officer at the scene was acquainted with Pletnikoff, knew he had special needs, and addressed Pletnikoff by name during the encounter. The settlement amount was $265,000. Nick's mother and guardian, Judy Pletnikoff, says she's glad the legal battle is over, but she didn't get what she set out for.
Money is what we did not want. And I walked into the lawyer's office first day saying, we don't want anything but an apology. We want to sit down with the city in good faith and have a conversation about what happened and how we can move on from here.
KMXT reached out to the city manager and city attorney and did not receive a response by deadline. However, city attorney Bill Ingoldson did tell the Kodiak Daily Mirror newspaper that the city settled partly because it was concerned a jury would not understand the police officer's point of view. Native hunters in Alaska are about to see an increase in the number of polar bears they can harvest from the Chukchi Sea bear population. The commission responsible for setting that limit recently raised the quota from 58 to 85 bears per year, shared equally between Alaska and Russian hunters. The quota increase was based on new science and traditional ecological knowledge indicating that the polar bear population is doing well. Eric Regier is a polar bear biologist and one of the scientists who advised the commission.
Currently, the nutritional condition or the fatness of the bears in the Chukchi Sea is on par with what it was 20, 30 years ago.
In 2010, the U.S. and Russia put a limit on the number of polar bears native hunters were allowed to harvest from the Chukchi Sea population. It was part of an effort to conserve the animals in the face of uncertainty about how they would respond to sea ice loss. Regier says the new research indicates that the population numbers and reproductive rates of the Chukchi Sea polar bears are good, but that doesn't mean there aren't concerns for the future.
Sea ice loss associated with climate change is the primary threat to the species, and we don't know when or how it may affect Chukchi Sea polar bears, but we would expect from a scientific perspective that at some point in the future there will be some negative effects.
On average, Alaska native hunters take about 30 Chukchi Sea polar bears a year. Katya Wasily is executive director of the Alaska Nanuk Co-Management Council, the group that represents Alaska native polar bear hunters. She says the good health of the Chukchi bears is cause for celebration. But while ANCC is pleased that the harvest number has increased, Wasily says the group was advocating for an even larger quota.
When you introduce something like a quota, that creates a different atmosphere, one more of anxiety, of competition. And our hunters were concerned about that. So they wanted just a cushion, the freedom to be able to manage through our own traditional values, our own traditional practices.
The commission that sets the harvest limit reviews the quota annually. A quota has been in place since 2010, but as of yet is not enforced. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite slow runs at the beginning of summer, Pilot Point fisheries get busy.
We went from like 18,000 pounds to like 60, 70,000 pounds in like less than a week.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Alaska state troopers say five commercial fishing vessels illegally caught and transported thousands of pounds of salmon near Homer in late July. According to a trooper dispatch released today, a wildlife trooper observed operators of the fishing vessels Little Star, Relentless, North Star, and Wind Star working together in Dogfish Bay to drive salmon out of waters close to commercial seining and into areas open for commercial harvest. Troopers say the vessels harvested fish in closed waters as well. A fifth vessel, the Maranatha, was also said to be present and allegedly transported some of the illegally caught fish. Troopers seized all 33,000 pounds harvested during the alleged incident, which troopers say took place during the early morning hours on July 20th. Homer residents Eric Winslow, Paul Roth, and Mark Roth were charged with driving salmon in closed waters among the charges. Robert Roth of Anchor Point was charged with failure to complete fish tickets and unlawful possession of commercial fish. All charges were filed in Homer District Court. Out in Ugashik Bay, fishermen are used to their sockeye showing up late in Bristol Bay's salmon season. This summer was especially trying, but for some, the wait was worth it. KDLG's Mitch Borden reports from the village of Pilot Point.
Conrad Day and his crew tow a net into the Ugashik River in preparation for the incoming high tide.
Now we'll just wait on the switch, because when the water floods, the fish come with it. It's like a free ride upriver.
Things are quiet out on the water tonight, but a few days ago, the river would have been full of fellow set netters preparing for the evening sockeye run.
There's like four boats anchored out, but earlier in this week, there was probably between 20 and 30 boats anchored out, and you know, every one had a crew of 4 to 5 people, so it's crazy how Pilot Point will go from a ghost town to, you know, an extra 300 people walking around, and then a few days later, it shuts off again.
It's the end of the season, so a lot of people have packed up and headed home, but there are still a few set netters like Day fishing. He's a college student at Texas A&M, studying nuclear engineering. Set netting has been a great summer job for him the last 3 years. Every salmon that strikes the net in front of him is a little more money towards his education.
It's actually a lot of fish.
How many do you think just hit?
Probably between 20 to 50.
Even though the salmon are hitting now, for a long time, things didn't look good in Ugashik Bay. This summer's run was so slow for so long that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed down commercial fishing in the beginning of July. But then the fish hit. The district was open, and from July 13th to about the 23rd, things got busy.
We went from like 18,000 pounds to like 60, 70,000 pounds in like less than a week.
This has been Traveler Turpening's best year ever in Pilot Point. His crew pulled in over 125,000 pounds of sockeye. The Ugashik District's run is almost up to 4 million salmon. That's about a million sockeye higher than the area's average for the last two decades. But the way Turpening sees it, a good season depends on more than the number of salmon returning.
It doesn't really matter if we have a huge run. It's all about, do the drifters come down? You know, how do the fish come in? How do the tenders serve us?
And this summer, a lot less drift boats fished in Ugashik compared to last year. Turpening says that let plenty of sockeye through to fishermen along the beach. On top of that, there were plenty of buyers for set net sockeye, and fishermen are getting around $1.25 per pound, plus quality bonuses for bled and chilled salmon. That's up almost 50 cents from 2 years ago. This year's late run was a roller coaster ride, but Turpening says that he expects every summer to hold a lot of surprises.
Every season we say, God, this is a weird season. And then we reflect and say, oh, we said that last year. And we say that every year, actually. So every year is a weird season.
In Pilot Point, I'm Mitch Borden.
A major player at the Federal Communications Commission is due in Unalaska tonight. Commissioner Brendan Carr will spend about 24 hours on the island to learn about the broadband challenges facing rural Alaska. KUCB's Laura Craigle has more.
The FCC regulates communications across the country, from radio and satellite to television and internet. Brendan Carr joined the agency as a commissioner last summer after the Senate unanimously confirmed his appointment by President Donald Trump. Since then, he's helped the Republican-led FCC to repeal net neutrality protections and spearheaded a $100 million program to expand access to telemedicine. Carr's short trip to Unalaska, however, is expected to be educational rather than policy-driven.
To get sort of a feel for the place. I don't think it's any more complicated than that.
Dan Boyette is a vice president at GCI. He says Carr will tour the telecom company's local facilities, along with the island's other providers, Optimera Wi-Fi and TeleAlaska.
He's a relatively new commissioner, and there's a lot of Alaska-based issues in front of the FCC at this point, so I think he's just looking to learn.
Those issues include how to develop infrastructure in rural areas and how to manage competitive federal subsidies that help pay for those projects. Overall, Mayor Frank Kelty says he wants to emphasize that Unalaska's slow satellite service affects everyone, from individuals and businesses to schools and the clinic.
I don't know if we're going to have enough time to do everything, but they can get made fully aware of the needs that we have in this community and the lack of conductivity.
Carr will be escorted by the staff of U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, who encouraged the commissioner to visit the island during his first trip to Alaska. A Sullivan spokesperson says the senator heard about Unalaska's broadband struggles during his own trip in 2016 and thought this would be a, quote, perfect community for Carr to visit. The commissioner will stop in seven other communities during his five-day swing through the state, including Anchorage, Dillingham, and Ukiagvik. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
A national wholesale food supplier that serves some Alaska grocery stores is having shipping problems from Tacoma, Washington. As KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports, it's impacted the bottom line for a Petersburg grocery store during its busiest time of year.
Hammer & Wecon Grocery is supplied by the wholesale company Super Value, headquartered in Minnesota. Hammer & Wecon's general manager John Mason says Super Value has been moving warehouses in the Seattle area and has been going through some challenges.
Those challenges have resulted in product not getting on the barge, product not being sorted out and sent to the right location, product missing the barge entirely.
Groceries are shipped to Petersburg and other island communities on Alaska Marine Line's barges. Mason says Super Value's missed shipments have impacted most products in the store, from produce to meat to frozen food, deli, and dairy products. Mason says the supply problems started at the end of March and have gotten worse into the summer. He and others with the store have been fielding questions from customers.
Most people who do make comments are wondering why we seem unable to get the shelves full or keep them full. And I wanted the general public to understand that it has nothing to do with our lack of desire or resolve to make this happen. But some of these things, if not most of these things, are out of our control.
For his store, it has meant a loss in revenue during the busy season when fishing boats and cruise ships and local residents are stocking up weekly. Hammer & Wecon has secondary suppliers, but those groceries have to come by air freight. And Mason says the company is eating those extra costs.
It's had about $300,000 impact in sales since the first of the year, and a considerable amount of profitability in what should have been our very best quarter of the year.
Hammer & Wecon became a customer of Super Value a little over a year ago when that company purchased another distributor called Unified Grocers. A company spokesman for Super Value writes in an email, quote, "We've experienced some challenges with shipments out of our Tacoma, Washington distribution center as we transition out of another distribution center in that region. We're working closely with our customers to address any disruptions they have encountered. This is a top priority for us, and we are working diligently to resolve the issues as quickly as possible," unquote. Super Value supplies a network of over 3,400 stores nationwide and bills itself as one of the largest grocery wholesalers and retailers in the U.S. with annual sales of $14 billion. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
If you were in Kodiak this morning, it felt more like Hawaii than Alaska. John Selman, a meteorological technician with the National Weather Service in Kodiak, says the warm temperatures are due to northwest winds.
Anytime we get a northwest flow, and we all know that it gets really hot in the interior, we get all that warmth that kind of funnels down towards Kodiak, and with that northwest flow, it's almost guaranteed that we're going to break 70.
And by 12:56 p.m., it had reached 78 degrees. That's a record breaker. The previous record was 75 degrees on this day in 1941. Anchor Point residents are looking to form neighborhood watch groups following complaints that Alaska State Troopers aren't responding to calls. As KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, tensions are rising over the perception that crime in the area is on the rise, though crime stats aren't available.
The 70 or so Anchor Point residents that packed into a senior center Tuesday evening are fed up with crime in their community. the head of the Anchor Point Trooper Post attended to answer questions about state-sanctioned neighborhood watch groups, but the meeting quickly dissolved.
Government has failed us miserably, okay? When may I kill the bastards?
Frustrations were apparent, and there were overtones of vigilantism. One group stood in the corner with shirts that read Tweaker Hunter. Anchor Point resident Jerry Glasgow found those sentiments counterproductive.
So you better watch what you're saying, because that's what everything's cranking up. It's scary.
Sergeant Daniel Cox runs the Anchor Point Trooper Post, which he said is down to troopers. He told the group that means there are times. It's unstaffed and it takes longer to respond. As for the comments about using deadly force, he told residents that they need to stay within the bounds of the law.
If you, God forbid, find yourself in a situation where you have used deadly force, you're going to have to explain to the investigators why you took that action.
It's clear that tensions are rising. What isn't known is whether crime is actually up. Alaska State Troopers couldn't immediately provide crime stats for its Anchor Point post, and a public records request filed by KBBI is pending. The following morning, about 30 people returned to the Senior Center for a workshop on forming neighborhood watches and practical tips on securing their homes.
When I talk about design, I'm talking about the physical design of space, whether it's your property, whether it's your neighborhood,
Naomi Sweetman works for the Department of Public Safety, and she's giving advice on what's called crime prevention through environmental design. The workshop she's putting on is part of a statewide initiative to help communities struggling with crime.
And the criminal looks at a home or an environment, says, and an animal does the same thing. This is a good place or a bad place. This is good for me to be in or bad.
Bob Stark attended the workshop. He lives on Tall Tree Avenue, a rural stretch of road that has a reputation. And he likes the idea of a neighborhood watch, but says his neighbors mostly keep to themselves.
It's just basically barricade yourself in your place, put a gun next to the door, and think, if someone comes in here, I'm going to shoot. And, you know, I don't want to shoot anybody. I don't even want a gun. So
Sergeant Cox thinks neighborhood watches could help push crime outside of areas like Tall Tree and eventually the community. But he says it will take more than just one neighborhood to be effective.
But every major initiative starts with somebody grabbing the reins and going forward. And I think we have that here.
But the real test will be whether these isolated neighbors on the Kenai Peninsula are willing to come together for a common cause. Reporting in Anchor Point, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Some aspects of life inside Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward are surprisingly similar to the world outside of the prison walls, even down to the donut sales to raise money for a good cause. Reporter Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk learned about Spring Creek internal economy and how that fuels the prison clubs.
At the heart of the economy is the prison store, where inmates can buy food and clothing.
Burritos, cheese burritos that are a dollar for the burrito.
The profits from the store are distributed to seven different prison clubs. Think of them as nonprofits, each with a different focus. The Time Club supports educational opportunities. The Alaska Native Culture Club offers sweat lodges each week. And the Bonsai and Horticultural Club grows plants.
These are spider plants, which I don't know their scientific name. These are some kind of, but I don't even know what these are either. That's an avocado tree.
Keen Crawford points to a tray of small plants growing in styrofoam bowls in shallow water. The club did focus on bonsai trees years ago, but then the administration banned indoor plants with dirt in them.
And they took them away because of the soil and people hiding stuff in the soil, allegedly. So now we got plants and just water.
Crawford started growing them for the guys in segregation. He hands out 2-inch cuttings, and some grow to multiple feet.
I think there's a couple guys who got big plants like that, and they're proud of them, the ones that held on to them. You know, it's something to show and just give a little break.
He says he's been to seg before, and a little bit of life can really improve things in the small, bare concrete rooms. Now he's growing plants for every inmate who wants one. Crawford's plants are just a small example of what the clubs do. Each club has a pool of money from their share of the store's profits, and they use those funds to improve the lives of the inmates. Sometimes that means buying communal property, like weight machines and guitars. One club provides scholarships to inmates so they can take college classes. Other prisons in Alaska have clubs, and each gets funding from a different source, like a surcharge on commissary items or cable TV.
This is our community, like I keep saying. If we don't support it, no one else is going to do it.
Mike Lawson, president of the Brotherhood of Alaska, says he took on a leadership role because the community inside the prison walls is just like the community on the outside. It needs people who are willing to give back. He explains that he's an elected official, like local government leaders, and he has to earn the prison community's trust to win votes.
You know, we have to be doing right out there for our peers to put us into these positions. And, you know, we have bylaws, we have rules to live by here and obligations.
The Brotherhood of Alaska buys games and chairs for the visiting room and helps put on banquets for inmates and their families.
And, you know, we furnish everything, food, drink, cake, ice cream.
For Christmas, they purchase gifts for every kid who's under 16. The events can cost thousands of dollars, which the clubs don't always have in their bank accounts. Other clubs need short-term loans for immediate, unexpected needs, like wires for the weight machine.
If we are short money, we go to the other clubs and we beg, borrow, and not steal, but beg and borrow.
Some clubs, such as the Bonsai Club, don't have to buy many expensive items. They mostly pay for garden and yard care once per year. So they've agreed to keep a cushion of money to help fill the gaps. They're like a charitable bank that offers no-interest loans. If a project requires more money than clubs can earn through the store, then they sell donuts or high-quality shoes as fundraisers. If they have extra money, the club leadership will talk with their membership and sometimes choose to donate it to causes outside of the prison, like research for cerebral palsy or the local wrestling club in Seward. They know that all communities are interconnected, and healthy communities lead to healthy people, like Crawford, the plant guy.
You put a little bit of water in the bottom of the cup so it just gets moist.
Crawford didn't enter Spring Creek as a philanthropic horticulturalist. Lawson's known him for years and says he used to be a little rough around the edges.
You know, when you first come into the system, you have like a chip on your shoulder. Damn the administration, the courts, and everything like that. And he's adjusted well and is becoming real positive for the whole community.
In part because of the opportunities for growth offered by the clubs. In Seward, I'm Ann Hillman.
Finally tonight, a correction to Friday's story about archaeological studies underway around Quartz Lake on its falling water level. An archaeologist who's studying early inhabitants' fish diet was Bree Dorning, not Fawn Carter. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Kayla DeRoche and Dela Eaton in Kodiak, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Mitch Borden in Pilot Point, and Ann Hillman in Seward. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
You know your teenager is struggling. Friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a fun outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings, youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.